Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about illegal weapons shipments from the United States to Israel. We are joined by two guests. Josh Paul resigned from the U.S. State Department in October 23 due to his disagreement with the Biden administration's decision to rush weapons to Israel. He had previously spent over 11 years working as a director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs. He is a non-resident fellow at the organization Democracy Now for the Arab World, or DAWN, and a recipient of the 2023 Callaway Award for Civic Courage. Mike Ferner, a previous guest on this program, is current director and a previous president of Veterans for Peace. He is a former city council member of Toledo, Ohio, and he is the author of Inside the Red Zone, a Veteran for Peace Reports from Iraq. Josh and Mike, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. There's not much talk about the legality of weapons being sent to Israel. There's not enough talk about the immorality, but there's almost none of the illegality. And Veterans for Peace has published this letter referring to six different laws that may be being violated. I think pretty clearly are being violated. For people who don't have a clue, can one of you fill us in on what some of these laws are?
Let me, I'd like to, before Josh fills us in on some of the particulars, I'd like to just mention that that letter came about because of a very interested citizen who is an attorney, but he has been on a volunteer basis doing significant human rights, First Amendment, and all sorts of public interest law. His name's Terry Lodge. He's from Toledo, Ohio. And he spent untold hours putting all that documentation together so that we could provide a concise chapter and verse of exactly what is going on, just in case anybody in the State Department or the Biden administration has not been watching the news lately. But Josh, I'm sure you have a little finer point you can put on that.
Yeah, no, that's right. And thank you both. Great to join this conversation. It's a really important conversation. Because, as you said, David, that that's not just about moral questions here, about policy questions here, but there's some real legal issues as well. There are several facets of U.S. code that I believe we are violating right now in the provision of our arms to Israel, and in some cases, quite transparently so. And yet, this administration has gone out of its way to not apply the law to itself in the context of Israel. This isn't new. I've seen this throughout my years in the State Department, working in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, where there is a double standard. There are, you know, laws that we apply to all of our other allies and partners. And then when we turn to Israel, we apply them differently. And I think what I and others have been arguing for a long time is not that Israel should be held to a higher standard or to a lower standard, but basically that it should be held to the same standard as we hold every other country.
So if I could just, for people's benefit, ask you about some of these particular laws. The first one is called the Conventional Arms Transfer Policy. Is this being violated?
Well, yes, it is. And let me just clarify. The Conventional Arms Transfer Policy is, as its name suggests, a policy rather than a law. And so the challenge you have there is that it is, well, theoretically binding. In practice, there is no legal enforcement mechanism for it. The Conventional Arms Transfer, or CAT policy, every administration, I think since Reagan, has issued some variation of the CAT policy. What makes the Biden administration's variation of it, which was published and promulgated by the White House, by President Biden, about a year ago, in February of 2023, is that for the first time, it actually includes directive language. What I mean by that is, historically, the CAT policy has sort of laid out a framework of, you know, here are some things to keep in the back of your mind as you are, you know, approving the export of U.S. arms. What the Biden administration CAT policy does for the first time is expressly say that, and I quote, the transfer of arms shall not be authorized if it is more likely than not, unquote, and then, if you know, that those arms will be used to violate, and it lists a series of, you know, of human rights violations. So I think it is clear in the context of Gaza that the arms we are providing to Israel, particularly things like air-to-ground munitions, tank ammunition, artillery shells, will more likely than not be used to commit human rights violations in Gaza. So that is, I think, a very clarion example of how the Biden administration, having set a policy in place, is simply setting it aside in this context.
I've always wondered about these policies and laws, the question being, how do you use instruments of mass murder and not violate human rights? Is it by killing people who are in militaries? Because almost every war kills mostly civilians. What would be a transfer of weapons to someone that where they weren't likely to be used in violation of human rights? Or does that have to mean not likely to be used at all? And then what was the point of making them?
Well, right. I mean, so again, the standard in the CAP policy is more likely than not. And, you know, just to be clear, having worked in the State Department on arms transfers, on security assistance for over the past decade, I do believe that there are a fair number of, you know, situations and scenarios in which the provision of arms has a valid purpose. You know, one of those, of course, is deterrence. One of those is self-defense. And I think we see that playing out very vividly right now in the context of Ukraine, which is facing a Russian onslaught that is in violation of the laws of war, of international humanitarian law. And, you know, Ukraine does have a right to defend itself, and I've been proud to have supported its right to do that. You are correct that in all wars, civilians do die. I think there is a fundamental difference between a partner or a party that does its best to adhere to the laws of war, the international humanitarian law, laws of armed conflict, and cannot avoid in some circumstances the death of civilians, versus a partner that takes no account of international humanitarian law and seems, you know, willing and intentionally to be killing, you know, many thousands of civilians, many thousands of women and children, as part of a strategy to essentially, you know, destroy the Gaza Strip. So I think there are differences here, and international human rights law, international humanitarian law, does lay out what those differences are.
One of the things that impresses me about that policy that David, you're referring to right now is, I can imagine, I can't swear to this on a stack of Bibles, but I can imagine the Biden administration has been proud and has announced its satisfaction any number of times with the fact that they have included this additional restriction or declarative clause, as Josh was mentioning, that makes it sound that much better than previous ones. And then what do? You know, they just go about business as usual. So,
That's right. And if I can add, I mean, so the Biden administration was particularly proud at the time that it issued this policy. And this policy is actually intended to reflect, although not incorporate, existing international law in the form of the Arms Trade Treaty. That is a treaty that the United States has not signed onto, has signed onto, but has not ratified, which, you know, specifies that arms should not be transferred where there is, quote, actual knowledge, quote unquote, of the potential for the misuse of those arms in the context of human rights violations, more likely than not, as a standard, was intended to reflect the actual knowledge standard in the Arms Trade Treaty without actually copying that language. So I think, you know, yes, we were proud at the time that we had, you know, sort of conveyed that standardization of American policy to international law. Of course, it is not touting the conventional arms transfer policy these days.
So that was the first of the six laws I wanted to mention very briefly. And you suggested that it was not enforceable, which was a very encouraging thing because it suggests that maybe the other five might be. And the first of them is called the Foreign Assistance Act.
Yes. Yeah, so the Foreign Assistance Act of 1966 is one of the foundational sets of laws that govern U.S. security assistance in particular, and contains a number of provisions that should, in theory, prohibit the transfer of arms to Israel in the current context. It certainly prohibits, for example, the provision of assistance to a government that is engaged in, quote, a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. I think, you know, many of us, including myself, would agree that one can look back many years across the occupation, which is, of course, in terms of, you know, the expansion of settlements, the existence of settlements, the siege of Gaza, predating this past fall in violation of the Geneva Conventions and of humanitarian law, and say that Israel has been engaged in such a pattern of gross violations of international recognized human rights. The problem with that particular requirement under the Foreign Assistance Act is it requires the president to make a determination. And this is the problem we see a lot in the US law, is that there is nothing forcing a determination. However, there is another example in the Foreign Assistance Act, which is now clarified or codified in US Code 22, US Code 23778-1, which expressly prohibits the United States from providing security assistance or any assistance to a country when it is known to the president that that country has obstructed the delivery of US-funded humanitarian assistance. In just the past week, we have seen National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan very clearly say that he is frustrated with Israel's obstruction of US-funded flour to go into that is supposed to go into Gaza. So that is, I think, a clear example where the president, where the White House knows that that obstruction is happening. And again, under the law, once that knowledge is existent, U.S. assistance cannot be provided to that government. And yet there has been no effort to enforce that law.
Well, we get into Ronald Reagan territory here with what this president knows about anything. Who enforces it? If the president doesn't have to enforce it on himself, someone else has to enforce it, right?
Let me, Josh, before you respond to that one, and I'm not sure of those six, how many of those this applies to, but Ralph Nader made a really good point in a column that he wrote lately talking about that letter to the State Department that includes those six laws. And he may have been referring to just one or two of them, I'm not sure, but he said, no citizen can sue the State Department to force them to enforce these laws about arms transfers. What has to happen is congressional committees have to have hearings, come to conclusions, and pass resolutions to make the State Department enforce them. So Ralph said, that's not likely to happen, as we know. So my rejoinder to that, when we sent Ralph's column out to our members, was to say, Ralph's right. Let's not hold our breath waiting for the Congress to do this. But in the meantime, that gives us more than good motivation to continue. And this is how I listed them: writing, calling, participating in protests, and sitting down in the streets to block business as usual. And I know that's not really part of the legal framework for these six laws, but clearly, none of those things are going to get enforced or taken seriously unless there's a political pressure to make it happen.
Well, go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say, I think that's right. And that's a thread that does run throughout all of these legal issues that we are talking about and are going to talk about, is the right to private action. There was a case that was brought by CCR and by the Defense of Children International Palestine against the Biden administration in federal courts in the last couple of months, which was argued on January 26th in a California federal court, essentially saying that the Biden administration should be enjoined from providing lethal arms to Israel in the current context under the Genocide Convention, to which the U.S. is a party and to which the U.S. has passed implementing law. This is one of the six laws that we're here to talk about. Part of the government's response to that case was that there is no right of private action, that if the U.S. government wants to prosecute itself, then the Department of Justice may do so, but there is no means for private citizens to pursue such action. I think, frankly, that remains an open question. The court didn't even get around to considering that aspect of the defense's argument. It instead, relied on the political questions doctrine to dismiss the case, although I understand that case is pending appeal. But that is certainly a valid question here of what do you do when the U.S. executive branch is not enforcing law against itself, and Congress as well, particularly in the context of Israel, has no interest as a collective body in taking the appropriate actions.
You put a fire under their butts, I think.
Well, I think that's part of it, right? And then I think we also have to remember that there are other bodies out there beyond the United States that do have a remit yeah. here, such as the International yeah. Criminal Court. Yeah. And I suspect that it is in those international bodies rather than in U.S. domestic courts that we will finally see some action here.
Well, just to get the names in addition to the Conventional Arms Transfer Policy and the Foreign Assistance Act, the laws we're talking about, one has been mentioned already, the Geneva Convention, well, the Geneva Convention Implementation Act in U.S. law, the Leahy Law, the U.S. War Crimes Act, and the Arms Export Control Act. Do these all have similar strengths and weaknesses here in terms of enforcement?
Josh, what's your take?
So, yeah, I mean, I think there are similar threads here, right? Just to very quickly touch on two of those, the Arms Export Control Act and the Leahy Laws. The Arms Export Control Act, for example, provides purposes for which U.S. transferred arms may be used. Those include legitimate self-defense, internal security, and contributions, for example, to, you know, peacekeeping operations under the U.N. Charter or collective self-defense operations under the U.N. Charter. None of those in legal terms, apply to what Israel is doing in Gaza right now. And the U.S. the Arms Export Control Act is very clear that U.S. provided arms may only be used for the purposes for which they are furnished. Again, we hit that problem of enforcement in the absence of executive willingness to enforce. The other one here, and this is an interesting case study, is the Leahy Laws. The Leahy Laws, named after Senator Pat Leahy, recently retired of Vermont, essentially say that the U.S. cannot provide military assistance to any foreign unit that has been credibly alleged to have been involved in gross violations of human rights. There is a system that works around the world when it comes to the U.S. working with units that have a track record of having been credibly alleged to be involved in gross violations of human rights, where, you know, there's a process before assistance is provided, that units are reviewed, personnel are reviewed, there is a database against which they are reviewed. And if flags arise, they are not provided with that assistance. For the case of Israel and just a couple of other countries around the world, there is a separate process in the case of Israel, that is the Israel Leahy Vetting Forum, where essentially the approach is, look, we're providing so much military assistance to Israel, it would be impossible, poor State Department bureaucracy to vet, you know, all of the Israeli security force units that are receiving this assistance before they receive it. So we'll just give it. And then after having provided that assistance, I would argue in breach of law, we will essentially be on the lookout for allegations of potential gross violations of human rights. Of course, in the context of Israel, the US has never come to the conclusion and never sanctioned a unit or person under, you know, the Israeli security forces for such violations, even though it has reviewed what I can tell you are plenty of examples of what are very credible allegations of gross violations of human rights.
But they can and do it, at least in the case of in Sudan, the Special Response Force, that whole tragedy and collection of war crimes that's been going on. Secretary Blinken did say they were in violation. So clearly, when it comes to countries and organizations that aren't on our favored list, those decisions can be made. And I wanted to throw this one thing in. I know we're running along here. Josh mentioned, you know, if the executive won't enforce the law on itself and Congress isn't willing, then you have that whole train of what's next. And I just want to bring this up. One of the things that Veterans for Peace is working on, and just at the beginning stages, is to try to get our activity and our statements to include a focus on who is actually governing in this country, because we know you can't get the executive to enforce the law on itself. And we know the same thing is true of 98% of Congress. Well, how did we get here, and who elects those people, and where does the money come from in the corporations that are benefiting from the arms sales? And they fund the people who get elected who don't make sure the laws are enforced, and on and on. So I think it's wonderful that we're putting forward these six laws that are being violated, and we need to draw as much attention to them as possible. But we can bang our head against a wall for another couple generations and not make those laws get enforced until we start figuring out how to start running our own government, I guess, in a short way to put it.
I think very well put. Tell me if you think I'm wrong, but it seems to me on Capitol Hill, the radical progressive position is, you know, demand a ceasefire while providing unlimited weapons, no questions asked. And the really extreme, like two or three Congress members' position, is to propose to redundantly create a new law to ban shipping weapons to Israel. I mean, they would always love to propose a new law rather than admit that there are half dozen laws already being violated. So is it a useful strategy to push those best Congress members to admit that laws already exist that are being violated rather than propose another damn law? Or is it more strategic to focus in general, as you suggest, Mike, in taking over the streets and nonviolent pressure on the Congress and the government and the society in general?
Well, that's, you know, that's a question of, unfortunately, we've already answered it, that we can, in fact, walk and chew gum at the same time. And so there are those of us who need to up our game about getting people in the streets. We can always do more of that and do it better. And there are people that, thankfully, like Josh Paul, who have inside information, and lawyers like Terry Lodge, who constructed this letter, who can take that on. And the government needs to be, I mean, this is supposed to be our government, right? And it's not doing what it's supposed to do. So we should be hammering at it from every conceivable angle. So,
Josh Paul, when you resigned months ago now, there were reports, including from yourself, of some number of your colleagues being inclined to agree with you, likely to do something. Have any of them done anything?
Yes. And I think it remains the case that there are a lot of people, and probably, if anything, a growing number of people within government, within both congressional staff, but also within the executive branch itself, who do not support the current US policy and are doing what they can to try and raise concerns about it and to change it. You know, I've heard from hundreds of people, not only within the State Department, but I've heard from people within the Defense Department, the White House, the Department of Justice, the Department of Commerce, the US Treasury, the Department of Homeland Security. I could go on, all of whom saying, you know, what we are doing is not only wrong and not only illegal, but also is not in the US interest. This is undermining our relationships across the Middle East and our global moral credibility. And our ability to rally partners and allies around the causes that we believe in. You know, some of those individuals have signed letters. There have been some very public letters signed by over 1,000 people, for example, from the U.S. Agency for International Development. There was a letter a couple of weeks ago from 800 civil servants, both in the U.S. and Europe, sort of, you know, speaking up, standing up, and opposing the current policy. We've seen people standing in protests and in vigils outside the White House. And using internal dissent mechanisms such as the State Department's dissent channel. You know, I don't know that any of this has really resulted in a change of policy because, you know, at the end of the day, as Mike has said, this is a political challenge. Yeah. And the politics right now are trumping the morality, the law, the policies. But there are certainly a large number of people who are deeply concerned.
Josh, is there anything that we can do in Veterans for Peace and our colleagues in the movement? Is there anything that we can do to assist you or any of the your colleagues that you mentioned to, if we could just get to know some of them, that would be nice, to encourage them to speak out more publicly? I mean, I know it's easy for me to say I don't have anything at risk, and they would be risking something as you did, and bless all of you for that concern. But if there's anything that you can think of, whether you can mention it here or offline afterwards, where we could be more supportive of people who have those concerns so that they know that their concern is appreciated and that we would do whatever we can. I mean, there are, we have legal assistance, things within the government, the whistleblower protection and so forth, but also some really good organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, that have people, dedicated people who have a long history of representing and supporting people who do step out.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these people, frankly, are feeling quite alone, right? There is a climate of fear when it comes to raising criticism of Israel within the US government right now, as there has been for a while, but particularly right now. And, you know, in many cases, I have people reaching out to me and saying, you know, I don't know who I can talk to about this, where there are others in their very same office who have also reached out to me. And I'm able to say, you know, just go to talk to the person down the hall because they aren't able to say this publicly or they aren't able to express themselves freely, you know, even within the office environment. So I think to the extent that those of us outside of government can provide reassurance, can provide, you know, support publicly to those who are speaking up, to those who are, you know, signing petitions, signing letters, you know, endorse what they're doing, praise them for what they're doing. I think it's certainly helpful to those, you know, who do not, you know necessarily that there is this sort of, you know, a very, I think, broad public support for the stance that they are taking. So I think that would certainly be, you know, the more we can express and support them, the better.
We
Well,
have
please, at
just a
least.
couple of minutes left, and I would love to go on for hours, but I hate to go off on a tangent, but I cannot not ask the question of if the contrast with the bad weapons to Israel is the good weapons to Ukraine, is there any concern with all the reports of the US and allies preventing peace negotiations from the early days after the Russian invasion to this day? If that is the policy, how is it justifiable? How is it a humanitarian good to be sending all of these weapons that are killing on a vastly greater scale thus far than in Gaza, Ukrainians and Russians?
Yeah, well, of course, let me just clarify that when you look at, for example, the number of children who have been killed, it is vastly more in Gaza in 4 months than it has been in Ukraine over 2 years. You know, I think what this boils down to is the notion, the ideal of self-determination, that every people in every country deserve the right to decide for themselves through their democratic organizing, you know, what rights they have, what their borders are, what their rules are. That is a right that has been denied to the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people do not have self-determination. What they have is occupation. It is also a right that is being denied right now to the Ukrainian people, particularly those who are under Russian occupation in Crimea and in the Donbas. So I think we can stand up for that right on a consistent and global basis, and understand that sometimes that requires, you know, providing security assistance, in order to enable self-determination.
But if they don't have the right to negotiate a peace settlement, if they don't have the right
They
to
have
make
the right. It is ultimately their call. It is ultimately the call of the people of Ukraine. And to this point, the public polling of Ukraine does not suggest any interest or trust in peace negotiations with the Russians.
Well, it seems
Be
it
before
wasn't. Go ahead, Mike.
I'm sorry. Before we go further on that one, Josh, if you would please, if nothing else, make sure that the people you know who are looking for some support get my email, but then return to the previous programming here.
Absolutely.
Well, I think this will have to be continued in another episode. I want to thank Josh Paul and Mike Ferner very, very much for everything you're working on and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.